Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Santa Clara Convention Center. My name is Dan Ashley, anchor at ABC 7 News in San Francisco and member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. Our thanks to the Corrett and Toby Family Foundations for supporting today's American Value Series program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our guest today, General Colin Powell, the author of It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership, which just hit the New York Times bestseller list. As one of our most admired and respected military leaders in this country, General Powell's service career began as an ROTC cadet at City College of New York. He spent 35 years in the U.S. Army, rising to the rank of four-star general. General Powell has devoted his life to public service, having held senior military and diplomatic positions through four presidential administrations. He was President Ronald Reagan's national security advisor and later served as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for both President George H.W. Bush and President Bill Clinton. He became, as many of you know, the first African-American and was also recognized as the youngest officer and first ROTC graduate to ever hold that position. In 2001, he was nominated by President George W. Bush and unanimously confirmed by the Senate as the country's first African-American U.S. Secretary of State. General Powell has received numerous military honors, including the Purple Heart, Bronze Star, Legion of Merit, and the Soldier's Medal for Bravery. His civilian commendations include two Presidential Medals of Freedom, the Congressional Gold Medal, as well as an honorary knighthood bestowed by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, just celebrating her 60th Jubilee, by the way. He is founder of America's Promise Alliance. That is an organization dedicated to improve the lives of children that is currently chaired by his wife, Alma. His wife of 50 years.
Yes.
General Powell is also a strategic limited partner in Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers, and board member at Bloom Energy. We are truly honored to have him here today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming General Colin Powell.
Thank you, Dan, for your kind introduction and a great pleasure to be with the Commonwealth Club and be back in the Valley.
We are delighted to have you with us. We read some of your many accomplishments, and your career is storied and filled with achievement. We talked about a number of firsts in the introduction. I want to start with a question that I know you never go anywhere without being asked, and that is that many Americans felt that you could be, even should have been, the first African-American president in this country. I know you're asked this continually. You detail in your book, which we'll talk a great deal about, why you chose not to try to become the first African-American president. Why didn't you want that job?
A lot of people were encouraging me to run, and a lot of people were telling me they didn't want me to run. So it wasn't quite as unanimous as Dan suggests. And I was not a political official at the time that this came up, when my first book came out, my memoirs in 1995. I was a career soldier until 1993, so I never expressed any political views. Nobody ever knew what party I might be in, and the answer was none. Because as a career soldier, we didn't do that. In fact, when I worked for President Ronald Reagan as his national security advisor, I was still an active duty military officer, and I never talked politics, and they never asked me in the White House what party I might be in, both to protect my military status, but I think they were afraid of what I might answer, so they didn't ask. But when I got out and then wrote my memoirs in 1995, I'm a civilian, and people started pressing me, and I gave it a lot of thought for about 6 weeks or so. And you feel an obligation when people are pushing you this way or encouraging you to do something. And I've always tried to serve my country in whatever assignment I have been given. But after a number of weeks, these 6 weeks studying it, I never one morning woke up thinking that this was the right thing for me. I didn't have the passion, the drive that one needs to be successful in American political life. And my family was not anxious to do this either. So it was 100% judgment within the family. Now let's find other ways to serve the country. We've served for 35 years. We'll find other ways to serve, but not in political life. And what I have found in the course of my life, and one of the things I've touched on in the book, you have to do that which you think you do well and which you love doing. And you have to really follow your instincts after bringing in all the information that's available. And my instincts told me that this was not the right thing for me or for my family. And so I announced that I would not be seeking political office. People have asked me almost every day since, do you regret it? And the answer is no. I made a decision that I thought was right for me and for my family. Therefore, I have no regrets. And we found other ways to serve. Secretary of State for 4 years, and all the work my wife and I do with youth programs in some ways probably as important as anything else that's going on in this country.
You mentioned, as an aside, you relied on your instinct for that decision. You relied on your instinct for another decision, again, that you talk about in the book, and that is some of the opportunities that you were afforded to get involved in the financial services industry. As you left public life, you chose not to.
I was very flattered when I left my position as Secretary of State at a number of offers that came my way from different financial institutions and other organizations in the New York community principally. And they were very flattering, very remunerative. But I essentially was just going to be sort of more figurehead than an actual financial expert. And I even said to one of these companies, what do you want me for? I don't know anything about hedge funds. Turned out they didn't either, but that wasn't the issue. And they said, don't worry about it. We have people who do know about it, and they'll advise you. Well, then they didn't really want me. They just wanted my name. And a good friend of mine in the financial business who I trusted very much said to me, why wear one of their T-shirts? Wear your own T-shirt. Remain independent, stay loose, do lots of different things, and you can serve in many, many important ways. So I turned them all down. And you talk about a close call, because all three of the principal companies that were soliciting my services all almost went belly up in 2008. And I would have been among the 8.2% of our fellow Americans who were unemployed. It would not have been a good deal for me. So sometimes, you know, you think you're passing up an opportunity. But if your instinct, after informing your instinct, after you've thought about it and considered all options, if your instinct is still sort of nagging at you saying, this isn't right, don't do it, it's not for you, then I always tend to follow my instinct, because it is not a guess, it is an informed instinct. And I cover in the book many examples of great leaders who made the most critical of decisions based on their instinct that was informed by the information they had collected.
So that's another decision that you have no regrets about making.
No, that one, no.
Thankful you didn't make that
thank
one.
You, thank you.
Let's talk about a decision that I wonder if you do have any regrets about, and that is your speech to the United Nations about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that was so pivotal in the decision to go to war. How did that come about? As we now know, there were no weapons of mass destruction. How did you get put in that position?
Well, let me just correct one point you made that was so pivotal in the decision to go to war. When I gave that speech, the decision had already been made. The president had decided in January of 2003 that he would have to take the war to Saddam Hussein. And 3 months before that, in the fall of 2002, the United States Congress, with an overwhelming resolution, 3-1 vote in the Senate, better than 2-1 in the House, had given the president authority to undertake military action if the diplomacy did not work. So the decision had already been made. And the way it came to me was after the president had made the decision but had not announced it and the troops were in place, we were just a few weeks short of war, he thought it was important that we present our case to the international community through the United Nations. They were the offended party, the United Nations. And so he asked me to do it, and work had been done on such a speech to be given by someone, and I was the one who was going to give it. The speech that I was given in the draft was not adequate. It wasn't backed up by the intelligence community. We couldn't cross-reference things. So for 4 days, I lived with my staff out at the CIA with a room full of experts and with the director and deputy director of CIA on top of all of this, and we put that speech together. Every word of it was verified and substantiated by the intelligence community, all 16 agencies of the intelligence community. So when I gave it, I was quite comfortable that even though it was mostly inferential case, it was a good inferential case, and it would stand the test of examination. I understood how important that speech was, not for making the decision, but communicating to the world what we saw and what we thought and putting my credibility and reputation behind it. And so the war came, and we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. We found a Saddam Hussein that, if left to his own devices and released from UN sanctions, would go back to creating weapons of mass destruction. But the actual presence of such weapons, we got it wrong. And then we discovered that some of the sourcing that we were using was not accurate and should never have been used. And so the whole case with respect to the presence of weapons of mass destruction fell apart. And I can tell you that I deeply regretted it, because I'm the one who presented that case most publicly. I've even had members of Congress say to me, you know, it was your speech that convinced me to vote for the resolution. I said, no, I'm sorry, sir, you voted for it 4 months before my speech. Nice try. And the reason I kind of tell you it that way is because a lot of people suggest that I was the key, and that speech was the key to all of the decision process that led to war. But in fact, it was an explanation of why we felt it was necessary to use military action. It's a war that I had hoped we could avoid. I persuaded President Bush, and he bought into it to take it to the UN, try to get Saddam Hussein to fess up to all he had and what he was doing or not doing. And Saddam Hussein did not do that to our satisfaction, and the president decided that military action was appropriate. I fully supported that decision, and I took the case to the UN, and in the rest of the spring period, in all my testimony and presentations, I supported the decision he made. My real regret is that we didn't prosecute the war as effectively as we might have. We thought that once Saddam fell and the government fell in Baghdad, it would all snap together again somehow. Whereas what I have been saying to the president is, if you break it, you're going to own it. If you take out a government and the people are standing around wondering what comes next, you become the government. You're responsible for their security and for their well-being. And we didn't handle that part of the campaign well. And then, as you all know, an insurgency broke out. The pressure that Saddam Hussein had kept on the Sunnis and the Shias and the Kurds to get along, or else, that pressure was gone, and we saw that they weren't going to get along that easily. And that ethnic conflict is still playing out. But when you read the papers today, you see that Iraq is doing better with respect to its economy, its infrastructure. It's pumping more oil than it ever did under Saddam Hussein. And so the Iraqi people, I think, have every opportunity to put together a solid country with a representative form of government. But like any democracy growing up from infancy, it'll take infancy, it'll take time, and there'll be difficulties. And that's the story. I was asked to present it. I was assured it was correct. It wasn't correct, and I regret that very, very much. And I essentially have become the, you know, example of it being incorrect, and I always get the question.
How painful was that for you personally?
It was very painful. When you put yourself on the line and you're representing not just yourself, but the president and the United States government, and you're working from information that's been given to the Congress, given to the president, given to our commanders, given to the world as being an accurate picture, but nevertheless, you become the symbol of that accurate picture, and then it all starts to fall apart, and you're sitting in your office, and suddenly somebody else comes in and says, oh, look, that turns out not to be the case. No, it isn't a biological van. It looks like it's just a truck. And you could see the case fall apart. It was painful because you knew that all the attention would be focused on your presentation. But as I say in the book, after I discuss this, well, what do? Do you go fetal and climb under your desk? No, I'm still Secretary of State. I got to get on with the work that is before me. And as I've learned over the years, when you have something that is as distressing as this, you have got to manage it as best you can, but then you got to get on with the other work that you have. And don't let failure sort of cause you to not be able to function any longer.
How much friction, General, was there with you and the rest of the Bush administration in those last couple of years?
In my last couple of years, we had differences and challenges with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan and other things. And that's got most of the press attention over the years. But what's interesting is that we did a lot of things that didn't get that much attention. They were very, very good. We increased aid to Africa and other undeveloped parts of the world. We helped with the expansion of NATO. We supported the expansion of the European Union. We put huge sums of money against some of the worst diseases that we are facing in the world, HIV, AIDS, and other infectious diseases like malaria and tuberculosis. And so we did a great deal in stabilizing relations with China, with the Russian Federation, but people don't remember that or don't focus on that as easily as they focus on the disagreements we had. And in early 2004, I said to the president that, you know, I only intended to serve one term, and frankly, we're not operating as we should as a team, Mr. President. And so I think you should change us after you win in the fall of 2004, which I expected he would. And the change should begin with me because my views tend to be so much out of alignment with the views of some of your other advisors. And so I think I should be the first to go. I suggested that. He agreed, and I left in January of 2005.
A couple of other questions before we move on to some more broader points. As 35 years in the Army, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Secretary of State, your thoughts on gays in the military serving openly and also women in combat roles?
Yeah. Gays in the military, when we put in Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 1993 after President Clinton came in office, it was very controversial. But people forget that the policy that existed then was far more stringent than the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy we came up with. And as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I had to represent the views of the senior leadership of the military and the non-commissioned officers and the chaplains, who had very strong views about this, considering the denominations we generally draw our chaplains from. And so everything taken into consideration, I and my colleagues in the Joint Chiefs did not think it was appropriate for us to go all the way with gays in the military at that time, so we put in place Don't Ask, Don't Tell, meaning keep your sexual preferences and activities to yourself. We won't ask, don't tell, keep it private. It was a discriminatory policy. It's not a policy that I would expect to see anywhere else in American life, but the military is different. We tell you who you're going to sleep with, we tell you who you're going to live with, who you're going to die with. And so we have always been allowed by the Congress to set rules that we feel are necessary for good order and discipline in the armed forces. And that's the basis upon which we rested it. I also said that times are changing. And as our society evolves, we have to keep reviewing this issue. And if the day comes when the senior military leaders who came after me say to the President, to the Congress, we can now accept and live with a new policy of eliminating Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I'm all for it. And when Admiral Mullen, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, several times after me, made that statement to the Congress under President Obama's administration, I fully supported it. I think the country has evolved to the point. And the policy has been the new policy, and the new law has been in effect for a year. And in my conversations with senior military officers, it is not causing any difficulties within the force. They're able to handle it, and that's good.
And where you believe it might have 10, 15, 20 years ago, it might have been more of a problem.
Well,
within
I'm quite sure, and it was not just the usual suspicions about, oh, they're going to start proselyting other soldiers to become gays. It was just the difficulty of, in a barracks life context, to tell soldiers who they're going to sleep with of a different orientation from them was creating very, very significant problems for us. Also in our communities, our spouses, our wives especially, were concerned about how this might change the nature of our community. We weren't ready for this kind of a change. And when President Clinton came in, I suggested to him, if you really want to move in this direction, give us time to study this. And that's what President Obama did. He had a task force study it for the better part of a year to analyze all of these issues and see if they could be managed. And the task force came back and said yes.
Let's talk about your belief, where you see women in combat roles.
Yeah, well,
should they be there?
They are there.
Frontline infantry sort of positions.
You know, when I first came in the Army, it was a very male-oriented Army. Women were waxed, the Women's Army Corps, as it was called. And then slowly, as I matured in my years in the Army, more and more women came in who could do all sorts of things, and we opened up so many specialties to them. And more specialties have been opened up in recent months, and I think that's good, and they're doing the job. They're dying in combat. They're serving as well as men are. I'm still a little bit old-fashioned, and I'll just fess up. I'm not sure that infantry and ground combat is the place for women. Not that they can't do it. I just think that there are pressures there, and maybe I'm just being a little too old-fashioned with respect to not wanting to see women in that kind of combat environment with men and getting themselves blown apart, although some are being injured grievously and killed now through IEDs and other things that are, do not ask for your gender before it goes off underneath you. But I'm still old-fashioned, and maybe it'll change before I'm gone, but I'm still old-fashioned with respect to women in direct ground combat and the consequences of that kind of action with an enemy.
All right. Let's talk to world affairs. Syria, which has become an increasing concern around the world and around the region, what role should the United States play? Is there a military role that the United States should play?
I think the United States should continue to play a diplomatic and political role, working with the international community. It is a very difficult situation. President Assad is somebody I know. I've worked with him, and I've met with him a number of occasions, and he's a total liar. he cannot be trusted on anything he says or anything he ever told me. But he is maintaining control of the country, and he has an army that is still loyal to him. So he has the wherewithal to fight this insurgency, this revolt, whatever you choose to call it. It's not clear who is in the opposition, who's revolting, and what do they represent. He is not only trying to protect himself, he's trying to protect his tribe, the Alawite tribe. And so it is not going to be a simple solution to this. I do not think it is appropriate or in our interest to intervene militarily with U.S. troops. This is something they have to resolve, and it may be resolved through the force of arms. Hopefully, a diplomatic solution might be found. That may not be the case. The other suggestion is, should we give arms to the opposition? I think you have to be very careful. If the opposition is not able to use these weapons, or if we don't know who we're actually arming, we might end up with a more dangerous situation and more people being killed as President Assad responds to this. So continue to support economic sanctions, diplomatic efforts, and political efforts, but I support the position of the president and almost all of the other members of the international community that it is not appropriate to send in outside armed troops. And, you know, there are a lot of countries who are going through this kind of turmoil. Should we send armed troops into Sudan because it is so vivid on our television screens? Lots of other countries like that who are going through this kind of turmoil. And there are just so many places that you can send your sons and daughters to fight. And you have to really think, is this in our national interest before you start committing yourself to deal with situations that are vivid on television, vivid in their in the violence and the horror that you see. But will the presence of American troops solve that? And if we do solve it, how long do we have to stay there to keep it from breaking up again as soon as we walk away? We've kind of learned some lessons in Afghanistan and Iraq that should inform what we might want to do in this situation.
Your thoughts on Iran and the nuclear ambitions of its leader and how you expect Israel to respond? What do you look for?
None of us want to see Iran with a nuclear weapon. And Iran can claim, well, we don't want a nuclear weapon either. We've been telling you for years that all we want to do is to have a power program that allows us to generate electricity. But we don't want a nuclear weapon. Well, there's no reason to trust them. But they haven't gotten to the point where they are about to create a nuclear weapon and put it on a system that will deliver it. And so I still think there's an opportunity for diplomacy to convince the Iranians, as we put more and more economic and political pressure on them, that it is in their interest to prove to us beyond a shadow of a doubt, by total inspections and the most rigorous inspection regime, that all you're doing is trying to create nuclear programs to produce electricity, and you're not on the road to a weapon. And I think it's still possible to do that. They're hurting. The economic sanctions are hurting them. I've only had a couple of meetings with the Iranian foreign minister when I was Secretary of State. And at one of the meetings in Egypt, we were just making small talk. We had to be very careful. We both were under instructions not to get too close to one another here. And just to make small talk, I said, what is the most significant problem you have in Iran these days, Mr. Minister? Expecting him to say something like Israel or... He said, finding 600,000 jobs a year. We have a young, growing population. We have to find jobs for them. Well, you're not going to find jobs for them if you're under sanctions because you're fooling around with nuclear weapons or nuclear programs. You can't eat it. You can't do anything with it except polish those things. They're worthless. But that's as far as the conversation went. Having said that, I don't know that it would be the proper thing to do, or the case can be made that a military strike from anyone at this point is the appropriate action. They can reconstitute whatever you bomb, and the response from the rest of the world might be more difficult than you imagine. So I continue to believe in a diplomatic and political push. But then I have to put my old hat on as the person who is in charge of or supervised the nuclear weapons of the United States of America. We had 28,000 of them under my supervision when I was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. As a corps commander, I was prepared to use nuclear weapons against the Russian army in Germany when we were still back in the Cold War. And as a young captain at age 25, I was taught how to employ them, how you actually fired them at somebody. And the one thing I've been persuaded of out of all of these experiences is that these things cannot be used. They should never be used. They cannot be used. They can be used to deter and to contain an enemy as we did with the Soviet Union. But the concept, the thought of loosing these weapons on the world is very existential in nature. And I do not think that any leadership in Iran, either Ahmadinejad or Khamenei or any of them, would sit down one day and say, gee, fellas, you know what? I'm so mad at Israel or I'm so mad at the United States that we're going to fire the one or two weapons we have at them. That's suicidal. They know what will happen the next day. And so their principal interest is remaining in power. And the easiest way for them to lose power would be either through overt threats or the use of these weapons to be taken out. Same thing with North Korea. North Korea has a weapon. They keep shooting rockets up that don't go anywhere. We still have to see that as a threat to the region and a danger. But at the same time, as I used to say in hearings when I was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the North Koreans know full well what will happen to them the day after they use one of these things. They will cease to exist as a society and as a nation. And they are not stupid. They only look stupid and act stupid, but they are not stupid. And I mean this now. They have a very clear idea of who they are and what they are. And they have this weird regime, but within that weird system, they're very rational. And they're the toughest, best negotiators I've ever dealt with in my career, the North Koreans. But they also know that if you want to stay in power, you have to find a way to deal with the rest of the world and give up these programs. And if you ever use them, you're no longer in power, and therefore they do not have an incentive to use them.
General, what made the North Koreans such good negotiators?
They're tough because they don't have the same relevant basis that we have. They lie. And they don't see a lie as a lie. When we lie, our feelings are hurt. We shouldn't have done that. With them, it's merely a negotiating point. And so they'll tell you something tonight, and we'll agree to something. And tomorrow morning, they'll come in, and as if they've never heard of it before, and they start all over again. And it's like water torture in the negotiations. And they are superb at it. And Admiral C. Turner Joy, was our negotiator in the armistice talks in the early 1950s with the North Koreans to stop the Korean War. They never did end it. And he wrote a marvelous book on the process of negotiating with them that I studied when I became chairman and secretary of state. And he tells one story where they negotiated for weeks over whether they should have an agenda for a meeting. And every day the North Koreans had a new objection, no matter what they agreed to yesterday. Tomorrow morning, they agreed to something else. And we kept getting mad. You know, Americans. Oh, come on, let's go. Come on, let's come on. Can't wait. Can we have a deal? And finally, we reached a deal with them. And everybody was happy. And Admiral Joy was happy. And then we discovered that the North Koreans really weren't arguing about whether we had an agenda or not. They were arguing about what should be the first item on the agenda. And we were worrying about the agenda. But they were beyond us. Once we get the Americans so mad that they will accept anything, they won't notice what the first item is, which is the only thing we care about. And so they have not lost that ability to negotiate. And in the last years of the President Bush 43's administration, they got their money back. They got taken off the terrorist list, and all we got was a tower that was blown down that they could put back up in a couple of weeks. They're good. They're very good.
Let's talk, General, about American military readiness. Where are we, especially given the economy and budget concerns, where is the United States militarily now in terms of our ability to respond anywhere around the world and to defend the national interest? And where should we be? Should we continue to scale back our forces and our weapons acquisition, or no?
We should continue to build a force that bears some relationship to the kind of threats we might face and also what America's responsibilities are throughout the world. Our force has never existed just to be ready to fight wars. Very often it's existed and been created to deter wars. So with our presence in Europe, the days of NATO and the Warsaw Pact, our presence in the Pacific, it's there to reassure our friends and let anybody know you really don't want to mess with us. We have the capability to deal with anything you throw at us. So let's not lose that capability. And let's at the same time recognize the world has changed. One of the biggest challenges I've ever faced as a managerial and leadership challenge was when the Cold War ended. And when Gorbachev, and I met with him as when I was National Security Advisor to President Reagan, he looked across the table at me in the Kremlin, and he smiled, and he says, "Ah, General, I'm so sorry. You will have to find a new enemy." And I thought to myself, I don't want to. We got a good deal going here, man. Just because you are having a bad year, why do we have to change? But the reality is we lost our best enemy at that time. Our whole structure depended on there being a Soviet Union that might attack us, and it was gone. Well, what did we do? Under President Bush 41, we reduced the defense budget by 25%. 500,000 soldiers went out of the force, 250,000 civilians, 250,000 reservists, because our worst enemy was gone. And we did it sensibly, and we're left with a good force. This time around, we have no peer enemy. There is nobody out there with either the capacity, the economic potential, the potential of population, or an intention of any kind to go to war with the United States. Only India and China have that kind of economic and people capacity, and they're too busy selling us stuff. Come on, let's face it. But a lot of my colleagues want to see China as a raging enemy that's coming at us because they're improving their military, so are we, and they have ships going through the South China Sea in places, so do we. But China has become so successful because they have been a trading partner of the West, not an enemy of the West. And China still has 800 million dirt poor people who haven't benefited, and they're waiting to benefit. And China has its own set of problems. And so see China as a serious partner who we have to watch, observe their actions in how they deal with their neighbors in the seas off the coast, how they build up their forces. But also remember, they have their problems, and we can work with them without seeing them as an enemy that's coming after us. That's really not the history of China. And India, of course, has been a friend of the United States for so many years. Even with its capacity, it has no interest in that kind of thing. So the kind of problems we're going to be facing are sort of the regional or modest military involvements, the kind that we have seen in Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that. And we have to pick and choose carefully to make sure that we really deal with those things that are in our national interest to deal with or to protect a friend or ally. But understand that if you're going to intervene in these places, you could very suddenly find that you own them. for an extended period of time until you can find a way to transition them to someone else. The force we have is still the greatest in the world, the best in the world. The soldiers, sailors, airmen, marine, and coast guardsmen we have are still untouchable by anyone else on the face of the earth. They have been pushed very hard for the last 10 years with repeated tours back and forth to Iraq and Afghanistan. And what they have done is absolutely remarkable. I've never seen anything. I've never seen a time in our history where we have asked so much of so few, because it's an all-volunteer force. And people say, shouldn't we have a draft? It was the American people who decided that the draft had to go away. I was against it when it happened. I was a young lieutenant colonel. I didn't like that the American people were kind of separating themselves from us after Vietnam. But then as I grew to become a colonel, general, and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, we all like the all-volunteer force. And we can create an all-volunteer force of a much larger size than we have now if there really was that need. And I don't see the need for return of a draft. One of the challenges we have as Americans is to take care of our returning veterans now. We have a lot of them who need work. They don't have jobs. A lot of them are homeless. And many of them and their families are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or the difficulty of traumatic brain injuries. And each one of us in our own community should reach out to a veterans organization and see if you can link yourself up with some veteran who could use your kindness and your warmth and your thinking about them. And not just a parade once a year, not just a dinner once a year to raise some money, but to be in their lives every single day. They need it.
Without question, well said. One of the things that has happened in the last 10 years of war particularly is the improvements in medicine,
yes,
field medicine, that have allowed, thankfully, soldiers and Marines to survive terrible injuries that they never would have survived before. On the downside, they now survive and live with these terrible injuries that we must contend with.
It's the toughest thing to go to Walter Reed and visit the orthopedic wards or the recovery wards. And you have protected the torso. You protected the groin. The helmet gives some protection to the head. And the injuries, more so than being bullet holes in you or stopped by armor, they're traumatic amputations from improved explosive devices or mines. And when one of those things blows up, the arms and legs come off. And you can, if the torso is not too badly damaged or if the brain injury isn't too severe, and you get them to a hospital fast, which we do, and we have miraculous, wonderful medical system that will stabilize them immediately and then prepare them for evacuation back through the United States, through Germany, Landstuhl, and other hospitals to Walter Reed and Bethesda and take care of them when they get back here. But I've seen so many of these youngsters, they're in bed in Walter Reed, and they've lost an arm or a leg or sometimes a quadruple. And the first thing they ask about are their buddies. Can I get back to my buddies? That's the biggest strength they have, the bond they have with their buddies. And that's who they feel they have to get back to, even when they know they can't.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley radio program broadcast today from the Santa Clara Convention Center. We are delighted to have with us as our guest General Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. My name is Dan Ashley, news anchor at ABC7 in San Francisco. The book that Colin Powell has just written is called It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership. And I'd like, General, now to talk with you about this fascinating book that you've written that has, I think, implications and instruction across a wide range of American life.
Yeah, I think so.
And terrific advice, I think, for young people in many respects, and also for older folks, executives, and all those in a leadership position or all those who aspire to a leadership position. One of the things you start with that seem to have guided you and informed you over the years are a list of rules, and you highlight 13 of those rules. One of the ones that I think you've probably faced a number of times, we talked about the address to the United Nations involving weapons of mass destruction. It's not as bad as you think is one of your rules that guide your life. Tell us why that is important.
It's the first of the 13 rules, and it's not as bad as you think. It'll look better in the morning. But then I say, this is not a prediction. It might be worse. This is just an attitude to have. And the reason I like that rule, and I use it all the time, and it was the first one, is a leader, when faced with difficulties or tragedies, that's the time you have to be most optimistic and display confidence that you can get on top of this tragedy. And if you feel that way, and if you can communicate that positive attitude to your followers, to your employees or to your soldiers, you're on the way to a solution. And it has been very typical of America. When you look at the terrible crises we had, let's say Pearl Harbor or 9/11, and our leaders stood up the next day and said, we're going to get on top of this. And as bad as it looks, it'll look better in the morning, and the morning after that, and the morning after that, until we prevail, until we get on top of it. So it's a way of reminding myself all the time to have an optimistic attitude. And then the last rule, the 13th rule, is related to it. It says perpetual optimism, feeling that way all the time, that you can make things better, is a force multiplier, meaning in military terms, you enhance the ability of your team, you enhance your ability to do something well if you are always optimistic that you can do something better.
One of the things you talk about in terms of a key principle of solid leadership is the notion that kindness works. And that is an interesting perspective from a military man, where often the military is so austere and so disciplined. And there's an old military line, I can't remember who said it, that love ends, fear doesn't. You've probably heard that. Why is kindness so important in terms of leadership, both in the military and in civilian life?
The only reason I wrote it that way is because it works. Kindness works. There's an image that all generals, us brass hats as they like to call us, I hate that term. Or when I was a State Department, I hated having my people called striped pants diplomats. Haven't seen striped pants in 50 years. I mean, give me a break. But I have found that we are not blustering people, Americans. To get things done, you have to bring people together. Especially in the military, we're going to be asking them to put their lives on the line. So you can be tough and you can be demanding and you can set high standards. But I've also found that if you do these things in a spirit of kindness and showing the reason why we have to do these things, and kindness in a way that gets their respect and shows them that you respect them, you can build a very, very powerful team on a basis of trust. And so I've always found that I got things done, more things done with kindness than without kindness. What's the alternative to kindness? Being a jerk? Yes. And so I've always found that even in the most difficult situations I've faced, where I've had to deal with people who are adversaries, I never sort of converted those adversaries into enemies. I understand how to deal with an adversary, but I want to make that adversary a friend. And by approaching it in a way that reflects kindness, reflects my strong feelings, but at the same time, I want to learn about your strong feelings, and let's see if we can find a deal here, a compromise. Something that's missing too much in our life in Washington now, where that kind of kindness that used to exist, even among the most intense adversarial relations within Washington, doesn't seem to exist now. So kindness works, and there are a few stories in the book that sort of touch on this theme. And the principal story that Dan's referring to, I think, is I had a minister come to our church for a year. He was in trouble. We didn't know what was wrong, and the bishop assigned him to us for a year. And we just took him in, and we took him in as a member of our family, and we were very kind to him. And on his last sermon, as he was leaving, and I was sitting in the back of the church, I was a senior warden of our Episcopal church, and he got up to give his final sermon, and I'll never forget one sentence he used. He said, "Always display more kindness than seems necessary, because the person receiving it probably needs it a lot more than you know." Mm-hmm. And I've always found that to be a good thing to live with, and I've found it to be true on many occasions.
General, one of the things that you talk about in the book in terms of fostering leadership and identifying the right people for the right job is this notion of pick people based on potential, not just performance. And you're talking, I think, in military life, but also in corporate life as well. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by that and why that's important.
I think it applies in any capacity, in any occupation. But in the military, it means a great deal to us, because in the military, you're creating your own leaders. If you need a battalion commander or a fighter pilot, you can't go hire one from IBM or somewhere in Silicon Valley. You got to grow them from being brand new officers or privates. And so in my case, 100 lieutenants came in with me, let's say. Only one of us is going to make general. And which one is it? And so we measure our people, both enlisted and officer, constantly. How are they performing? How are they performing? But the more senior you become, the more the focus is on not only performance, but potential. And that's a different thing. Okay, he's a great battalion commander, but has he broadened himself? Has he learned new skills? Does he have a better understanding of how to work with other services? Does he seem to have the potential to do just as well at the next higher level? And that is a much more subjective determination. You look at all of the reports of how this person, this man or woman, did in the past, and then you have to put your experience to work and your instincts to work. Will this guy do a good job if I promote him? Or will I be making a mistake? And it's a very human calculation you have to make. But that's what we do in the military service all the time. And usually performance gives you a pretty good indication of what future potential is. But I've seen a lot of mistakes made also, where people have been promoted when they shouldn't have. And if you'd really had a serious talk with them, they might have said to you, "Don't promote me." They knew that they were at their level of peak performance and potential, and they were doing a great job, and we needed them. But to move them up another level was putting them in a range of expectation that they couldn't meet, and you were doing a disservice to that person. And so I think this also applies in any corporate or business or educational institution. Measure performance, but make that very, very human judgment as to what that person's potential is for higher service. And if you don't see it there, don't think it'll suddenly emerge. It won't. And you'll find you've made a mistake. And you've done a disservice to the organization and to the individual.
Putting them in a difficult position.
Put them in a position where they will be mediocre or fail. And they would have been much happier if you left them where they were. And do a great job.
General, role models are important in all of our lives. I'd be interested to know who your role models have been when you were younger, and even today. And also, do you find that there are enough role models for young people today, or that young people are able to identify the right role models?
I've had role models throughout my career, and it starts with my parents. And I don't want to be too corny with this. But it was my two immigrant parents, two little people, 5'3", 5'4", who came here with nothing and built a life, low-income life. We lived in the tenements. And they had two children, and they had expectations for us. My sister was a teacher, and I was a soldier. And this extended family of relatives that I had, we kept all the cousins in play. There was no question about dropping out of school or anything like that. If you ever came home and said, "I want to drop out of school," they drop you out and get another kid. I'm so help me God, they would. And don't shame the family. Don't shame the family. And mind. Remember the old word? Mind your manners. Mind your adults. Mind your teachers. That was drilled into us. And if I hadn't had that kind of a start in life, it doesn't make any difference who my role models were in the future. And that's what we're missing so much in this country today, and this is why my wife and I spend so much time on youth programs. If you don't give kids the right start in life, and there's a chapter in the book called The Gift of a Good Start. Right? If we don't give kids a good start in life, then they're behind the curve. And that's why we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. And so the role models were my parents, my relatives, my aunts and uncles who kept me in play. And then when I entered the Army, the people who really taught me how to be an officer were not generals. They were the other senior officers to me, captains when I was a lieutenant, who taught me what it was like to be a soldier and what was expected of me. And they were good at it. Good old-time soldiers. And that's where I picked it up. Those are my real role models. Yes, I studied the works of generals and the actions of senior generals. And yes, I worked for great generals and I worked for presidents and all that. But that was just building on what I learned in my early years as a kid and in my early years in the Army. What I say to students now is look around, see people who are doing good things. You might want to see a general or a basketball player as a role model. But maybe when you walk into school, if you see a woman at 6:30 in the morning waiting for a bus to go to work at a low-wage job in order to make enough money to come home and take care of her children, you're not going to get a better role model than that. And then my final message to kids is stop looking for somebody to model after. Be your own role model. Set your own standards. Behave. Study hard. It isn't brain surgery, kid. Behave, study hard, believe in yourself, believe in America, and don't make excuses for yourself. And I make the point that when I went in the Army in 1958, I was in the first really generation of young officers in a unsegregated Army. Army finally was desegregated in 1954, and 4 years later, here I came out of Harlem in the South Bronx. And I still remember the sort of message that the Army gave me. Pal, we don't want to hear any hard luck stories about you and your immigrant parents. Don't tell us about you being poor and all the rest of that stuff. And don't tell us anything about you being black. We don't care. The only thing we care about is performance. You perform, you'll go well. You don't perform, you ain't going nowhere. Got it? Yeah, I got it. Okay. I can handle that. And the other thing I learned, which was important to me that I got from my family and from the early leaders in my life, was that, you know, you're going to be subjected to racial discrimination, even though the Army is fully desegregated. You're living in a country that is not. And you go off base, and you have to go in the back door of stores and theaters and things like that. And what they said to me was, just keep pressing on and let racism be a problem for the racist, not you. They're the ones who are wrong. And don't ever forget that, and don't let them ever get you down. And so I've had some assignments in my career where people said to me, well, you know, they gave you that job because you're black. They need some integration here. They need some affirmative action. That's why you got that job. And my answer is, I don't care why I got the job. I can tell you about a whole lot of people who couldn't have gotten the job at all before I came, you know, in the last generation. And the only thing that they're going to measure me by is not whether I should have gotten the job or not gotten the job. They're going to measure me on how I did the job. And if I go into a unit, I'm coming. And you're going to see a pretty good soldier. And when I'm through, you can measure what I did. And then you can decide whether you made a mistake or you did a good thing by putting me in that position. And just to take up, I got to needle Dan a little bit here. Because it's a point I make all the time. People will say to me, well, you were the first, what does it feel like to be the black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the black secretary of state or the first black president? And my answer is, not the way it goes. I am the first secretary of state who happens to be black. There ain't a white secretary of state out there somewhere. It's me. So I always put the black on the backside. I'm the secretary of state. Don't qualify it by saying I'm the black secretary of state. No. I want to be proudly noted as being black because it pays tribute to all those who came before me who never got the opportunities I did. But I always want to be judged not by my color or any qualification of my color, but my performance and whatever potential I might have. And I try to go through life with that attitude, not carrying a chip on my shoulder. Here I come. You don't want me to advance, you better beat me because I'm going to do the best I can. And it worked for me.
General, I was just going to ask before you needle me on that, because even, you know, in this day and age, when I introduce you with those words, I'm actually a little uncomfortable. Like, why should we point that out? But I wondered, is it something you'd rather not even be said? Is it a point of pride?
It's a point of pride. And people have said to me, why do you keep pointing out that, you know, why you keep talking about your black experience? And I said, because I owe that. Right. I owe that to those who came before me for 300 years and served this country and died for this country, and the country wouldn't serve them. And I owe that to them, that I stand on their shoulders. And I also talk about it so that I can communicate to the new generation the history that we emerged from. And I want young white kids to hear it, and young Hispanic and Asian and African American kids to hear it. So I'm proud of it, but I don't want it to be an identification of all of me, or the whole of my life. And that's the way I've gone through life on this issue.
Do we have the right level of leadership in the United States? And are there enough leaders demonstrating what it means, as you detail in your book, to truly be an evolved, effective leader? It seems that we have a culture that is screaming at one another a lot without necessarily a lot getting done sometimes or a lot of guidance, particularly for young people. Are you concerned about the state of leadership in America?
We have great leaders in this country, and they're all over the country, and I see them in so many different capacities. I see governors who are doing great things. Silicon Valley has been a breeding ground for great leaders in the information revolution. And what I would say to get to the heart of your question is, in our political system, particularly in Washington, there are great people who are great leaders, but the system increasingly makes it very, very difficult to exercise that leadership. The two parties in Washington have essentially gone to their corners, and they now have to reflect the orthodoxy of the extreme. And if you stray the slightest from the orthodoxy of the extremes, you get hammered. You get hammered on cable talk shows. And if you feel a certain way, you only listen to the cable talk shows that reinforce the way you feel. We don't switch over. You don't look on the other side to see if you ought to be learning something differently. And I think that makes it very, very hard for our leaders who are attacked for any lack of orthodoxy to essentially exercise the kind of leadership we'd like to see. This is far different than the Congress I knew when I was just starting out 30 years ago in high politics in Washington, where they would get together and talk and try to compromise. And that's become much more difficult now because of the orthodoxy of our positions, the flood of money in our political system coming from lobbyists who are trying to influence the tax code in one way or another, or a lot of the other aspects of fundraising in order to run for political office make it difficult to take risks like we used to. And so we'll get through this, but I'm deeply troubled that we don't have enough people stepping forward who could be leaders and trying to break through this incrustation of orthodoxy that is affecting our society at this time. But people have always emerged from American society to lead us to a better life and to a shinier future, and that will happen again. But I think we are in for some tough times until people realize that we got to start acting like our founding fathers, who sat there and made some of the most difficult decisions imaginable and compromised with each other because they were there to create a country, and now we have a Congress that can't even pass a budget. That's a heck of an indictment on them. But don't expect Superman to come fix it, either in the person of Mr. Obama or Mr. Romney. We're the super people, and we have to start pushing back against leaders in Congress and elsewhere, in our legislatures and elsewhere, who do not seem to be doing what the nation's interest is and seems to be focusing on staying in office, getting money for their particular projects, and not straying in the slightest from the orthodoxy of their party positions. We have to start looking for people who are willing to challenge the conventional orthodox positions.
General, you talk in your new book, It Worked for Me, about this isolation. And you just mentioned both parties sort of going to their own corners. One of the chapters of your book is We're Mammals. Hmm. And I'd like you to explain what you mean by that.
It's about kids. And the title is We're Mammals. And I started out saying, I love watching animal shows. I love, you just name it, Wild Kingdom, Animal Planet, you name it, I watch it. And I love watching lions and tigers and bears raise their cubs. And baby is born, stays very close to the mother, nursing, eyes eventually open. And then the mother lets the young cub stray a little bit away from her, but not far. Particularly a box of straying that's equivalent to the experience that the cub has at that point. And if the cub ever goes beyond that box, the mother goes and grabs it behind its neck and pulls it back in to the den, or pops it upside the head with her paw. And as the cub grows, cub learns and gains experience, and then the cub is introduced to siblings, cousins, aunts and uncles, and the big male lions that are hanging around roaring a lot, but that's about all they do. And the cub realizes, this is my family, this is it. And they all figure out their place in this lion society. And then as the cub gets older, the mother takes the cub with her when she goes to hunt. And that's how the cub learns how to survive, to hunt. And it goes on until about 2 years of age, and then the cub has said, get out of here, you're on your own. And, you know, you graduated and don't come back home. And it's thrown out. And I look at that all the time and say, are we the only mammals that haven't figured out that this is how you have to raise kids? Are we the only mammals who still think you can raise a kid and not pass on to that kid, as the lions pass on to their cubs, 1,000 generations of experience of what it means to be a lion and how you behave as a lion and what makes you different from all other animals? Do we really think we can just toss our kids out there, put them out in the street, not give them a safe place, not give them a mentor, not give them an adult to learn that experience from? The answer is no, you can't. And unless we understand that communities have to compensate whenever there is weakness in the ability of a child to get inspiration and nurturing and role modeling from a parent or an adult or a cousin, we got to come in and do something. The other animal story that's in that chapter that I love has to do with elephants. That's one of the nature reserves in Africa. They took 2 teenage adolescent male elephants and moved them to a new part of the reservation, away from the herd. And after a few weeks, they discovered that these teenage adolescent elephants were killing rhinos. Well, elephants don't kill rhinos. What's this all about? But they were doing it. They were killing rhinos. And their testosterone levels had shot out of sight. And so the rangers thought they'd have to kill these two elephants. And a very wise ranger said, no, you don't have to do that. Go get some adult male elephants. And they would. They went and got a couple of adult male elephants and brought them into the reservation with the teenagers. And within a few weeks, the problem was over. The teenager didn't know how to behave. And I have fun in the book. I can just imagine what those adult lion, my elephants were saying to the teenagers. You know, hey, man, don't be hitting rhinos. Elephants don't do that, man. What's wrong with you? You lost your mind? Or, hey, man, cut that out. Don't make me come up there and hit you with my trunk. You know, they know how to do it. Why have we forgotten this? It's the way I was raised, and I suspect it's the way most of you in this room were raised, with all of my relatives keeping me in play. There was a kid in a school in Denver, a Hispanic kid, went to a Catholic school, and he graduated valedictorian. And he's going to Georgetown, and he's at Georgetown now, and he came to see me a couple of weeks ago. And he was a failure until they stabilized him in high school and got him through. And he's giving a television interview about being valedictorian, and the interviewer says to him, how did you make it? What changed? He said, I was never, ever given the opportunity to fail. They wouldn't let me fail. They kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me. And I couldn't let them down. They never gave me the chance to fail. He said, and now I'm going to college. I have changed the history of my family. That's what it takes, that kind of intense interaction with children to keep them moving along and make themselves their own role models and have them believe in themselves. Not easy. And it ain't going to be done just by snapping your finger and giving them a standardized test. It's being done by getting the lives of children, even if they're not yours, getting their lives.
General, we've come to the last question, and I think you'll enjoy this one. If this is from a member of the audience. All of the advice you give in the book, congratulations on your 50th wedding anniversary.
Thank you.
What advice, give him a hand for that. It's for Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Secretary of State, not nearly as impressive as that, right?
Right. True.
What advice would you give to young couples today for a successful, happy marriage and family life?
Well, for the men especially, I say marry up. Marry
That's
up.
Key.
That's key. And do whatever she says.
Even more key.
It's even more key. But I will be honest. You know, I'm the provider, and I'm the big guy in the general, all that. But my wife Alma is the matriarch of the family, and she raised the kids while I was running around in Vietnam and Korea and all kinds of other strange places, or strange places in Washington and not home. And there was always a separation between the home and my work. When I came home, I wasn't cross-examined on what happened at the office or did I get in trouble or not. That was a different world than the world of the home. And my children, the three of them, are all in their late 40s and mid-40s now. They're all very successful in life. Never had a day's problem with any of them, or three of them, because home was home. And they never took me too seriously. That was important. It was important. Somebody asked my youngest daughter recently, Anne Marie, who she's kind of the smarty pants of the three of them. And somebody asked her the other day, "Oh, goodness, Anne Marie, your father's Colin Powell. Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that. Anne Marie, what was it like growing up with Colin Powell as your father?" And she looked and says, "He wasn't Colin Powell then." And she still feels that way today. I mean, even though I am Colin Powell. But it's, and there's another story in the book that illustrates the same point. Many years ago, when we first came in with the new battle dress uniform, like the soldiers I see in the audience are wearing, those camouflage fatigues, those were cool when they first came out. And I was a brigadier general, and I got mine, I put it on, and I put on my general belt, and I went home that evening for the first time wearing this uniform, and I walked in the door, and Anne Marie was laying on the floor watching television, and she glances over, and she shouts at Elma, "Mom, the G.I. Joe doll's home." The beauty of our marriage was that between the kids and Alma, there was always a little oxygen mask, imaginary oxygen mask hanging over my head. And any time I started to, you know, get out of control or get a little too big for my britches, I'd take a deep breath of family oxygen, and that would bring me back down to earth on what was really important in life. And I think if you read the book, you will find that I kind of summarize it all by saying, you know, the only thing that really counts at the end is your reputation, your good works, and the family you leave behind. And all the rest is superfluous.
Right. On that note, we'll end today. I hope you've enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like very much to thank General Colin Powell, author of It Worked for Me in Life and Leadership, the Corrett and Toby Family Foundations, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those joining us on the radio and the web. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club celebrating 100 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Well done.